The number of attendees trickling in is starting to dwindle, so the frequency of beats is going lower, so it's probably a good indicator. Hi, my name is Sipu Dev. I'm the co-founder and chief technology officer for Layer 7 Technologies. Today we'll be talking about a very specific topic, which is policy authoring and its role in governance. Sorry, people I guess are still coming in. So it's a little bit, we might get interrupted from time to time. I have talked before on the more general concept of policy and its role in governance and stuff like that. Today specifically I'll be talking about policy authoring and giving a demo. So a quick view for a review of the agenda. I'll start just sort of on a more general way of how ideally we all thought web services were supposed to work, and give a couple of examples. Obviously, you realize there's a gotcha in there. There's as to, you know, it's not really how we all thought it would end up being. And so we'll talk about some of the issues there. Then I'll introduce the concept of policy. The policy then introduce the connection between policy and governance. And we'll talk about policy enforcement, and then finally, the main sort of what we're driving at, the whole concept of authoring, and then I'll give a demo of using our IDE and how you would author a policy. Alright? So just a quick introduction about myself. I'm, as I mentioned, co-founder and CTO for Layer 7. I'm pretty involved in the standards community. I'm a co-editor for the WS Policy Work Group at W3C. I've been involved in WS Trust, WS Secure Conversation, WS Federation. I've sat on a couple of different technical committees at Oasis, Reliable Messaging, Secure Exchange, and so on. Previously, I was the lead architect for web services at IBM and lead architect for their toolkit. I'm one of the original authors of UDPI specification and so on. So I've been involved in this community for quite some time now. For good or bad, it doesn't matter. But, so some of these ideas and concepts that I'll talk about have been around for quite some time, and they have evolved over time, and we'll see how. First thing I like to usually talk about is remind everybody involved that there are business drivers for service-oriented architecture. It's not even though we know it is kind of fun and cool to do, we're doing it for a particular reason. All in the technology and the IT community, we need to realize that everything that we do needs to be serving the business drivers, right? So mainly, if you think about where service orientation started, I want to say 8, 9, 10 years ago, the whole concept of XML web service and service oriented architecture, there were two main drivers, inside the organization and outside the organization. I'm oversimplifying here a little bit, but, as a techie, I try to simplify things in my mind. Inside the organization, increased productivity was very important, so enterprise application integration became important. People were trying to integrate different applications together to give better tools to their employees. Outside the organization, the driver there, the pressure was on growth. So you need to integrate with partners faster and faster and sort of shorten the lead time. So these two pressures, led the organization to think of flexibility and agility. You want to be able to easily integrate different internal and external resources together. You want to add partners, you want to drop partners, you want to integrate with new partners and so on very, very quickly. You don't want to take 2 years and just $10 million to do it. You want to change IT platforms, you want to avoid vendor lock-in, if a particular tool is not doing it for you, you want to be able to change it and so on. The concept of just-in-time integration becomes very, very important, and from this concept we derive the architectural premise of loose coupling as a fundamental architectural principle, where loose coupling to me is when you build a system that rely on each other. If you change one, if somebody is on a cell phone or something, I think there's some echo going on, somebody just logged in. Okay, sorry. So if you're building systems where components rely on each other, loose coupling tells you if you want to change one of those systems, you shouldn't break the whole system. There is an echo. Somebody is on a cell phone. with a bad connection, you're causing an echo, I believe. Okay? Alright. So let's jump into the whole concept of how we all thought web services were supposed to work. So vendor managed inventory is a great example that I give. Well, if you think of a major retailer who does not want to manage their own inventory, they want to push that management, the cost of managing inventories, to the actual vendors and suppliers of their product. So they'll say to the, I don't know, to the salt manufacturer, you manage your inventory. They'll say to the, you know, to the pasta manufacturer, you manage your inventory on my shelves and so on. Web services is a great use case for that. And that's a great use case for web services. So the way you go through the mechanism, according to the web services trinity, if you want, you know, you wrap your inventory services with some kind of wrapper, web service wrapper, you generate the wizzle, you publish that wizzle to the registry, supposedly UDBI, then anybody who wants to access that service will grab the wizzle from the registry, which is the find mechanism, and then will create the full request, the bind mechanism, to invoke that service. So if Colgate, Palmolive, or whatever wants to find how many cases of soap they have on Walmart shelf, they would grab that wizzle, they would create an application that actually invokes the inventory service, and then they would see, and then they would invoke that service and get that response. But all that sounds really, really great in theory, because it actually works really well in the lab, and we've all tried to do that, and all work as pilot products in the lab, but there's a minor hitch here that, you know, I like to use that term, that expression, that in theory and practice are the same, but in practice they're not. There's two major issues here, and there's actually several issues, but two major ones that I want to concentrate on today in this particular mechanism. The first one is, so whatever happens to loose coupling, remember, the whole purpose of doing service orientation was to give us loosely coupled systems, to build loosely coupled systems. So here you think, look at, you know, as your get inventory level example, as I gave before, as that starts expanding a little bit, where you have internal clients, you have clients inside your company, and you have clients, maybe suppliers outside your company that are your partners, and you have different requirements, maybe different security requirements for them, different confidentiality and signing requirements, maybe even different logging requirements for these different clients. So if somebody, if your own internal procurement employees want to access your inventory system, you have a different access control mechanism for them, maybe a different logging than, say, if one of your suppliers wants to access your inventory system. Then in this case, you might want to use WS Security, you might want to require them to encrypt the request, you might even require them to sign the request, and you might want to log it for notification later on. So very, very different constraints, very different requirements, and different access control, security, and routing mechanism and logging mechanism for depending on which client. It could be different per client. So what happens when you do something like that is every time you make a change, not only, you know, all hell breaks loose, excuse my language, not only do you have to go back to your deployed code base for get your inventory system and make a change, every time you make a change like that, you break all the clients, all the customers that rely on that particular service to work. So all of a sudden, you've lost any kind of concept of loose coupling there. So what in fact you have done is you very, very tightly coupled your clients to your services. And this is just for one service. The other major issue that I want to talk about is, well, how do you control all these proliferation of rules? If you remember here, you see different rules, different audit logging rules, different signing, encryption, access control, confidentiality, different security rules for different customers. Now, where do you code these rules, and how do you manage them? How do you control this proliferation of rules? Now, as I told here, this is just for one particular service. What happens after you start moving your whole organization to service orientation? You've got a lot of different services and a lot of different rules per service depending on all your different clients and customers. All of a sudden, you know, this becomes a governance nightmare. Potentially, it has the potential of becoming a governance nightmare. Now, apologize, I think WebEx has messed up my diagram here, my slide. So it doesn't look very, very clear, unfortunately. But I think you get the idea of what I'm trying to say here.
Absolutely.
So then, if you look at this potential of having a lot of different services with a lot of different rules, a lot of different partners and clients and so on, and so this tight coupling between clients and services, and then this proliferation of rules and requirements all over the organization, you need to stop and think and get back to basics. Say, all right, well, how do I step back from all this, and how do I introduce flexibility into that system so I can govern it better, right? And the way you do that, you can think of software engineering principles. You know, if you want to decouple the variable part of an implementation from the invariant part. And so, in this business mechanism, to me, the invariant part is the business logic, the business functionality. What is that service supposed to do? Is it supposed to get you an inventory level? Or is it supposed to get you a quote for a stock or what have you? That is not going to change that functionality. So you code that, you have developers code it, you deploy it, you QA it, and you deploy it, and that's it. You never touch it again. Everything else around it all of a sudden becomes variable. That's the layer of policy that I talk about. So things as to what kind of access control, where does it live, what kind of transport, who's allowed to use it, under what conditions, routing, all that stuff is infrastructure, and that's the variable part, and that's the layer that I call policy. So that's what you want to decouple that mechanism from the business logic. So you decouple the policy part of the services from the business logic part. And these are the three main principles that I like to stress throughout the talk, is that these rules, this abstraction, this layer of policy, needs to be declarative, not programmable. You don't want any programmer to touch anything to do with your policy. It needs to be declarative. It needs to be configurable. You need to be able to change it easily without having to rewrite your code or redeploy your applications or anything like that. And it needs to be centrally managed in order to give you better governance. And we'll explore these concepts in the next few slides. Now, I talked a lot about policy. I just want to sort of back it back and define what policy is a little bit more, my view of it is, it's simply a set of constraints and capabilities that govern how a web service and its consumers plan to run. If somebody just logged in to the top, if you please use, if you have a cell phone or something, you can create a lot of interference. Thank you. Great, thanks. So simple policies typically include rules describing, for example, who can access that service, what kind of credentials they need to present, whether you require encryption or signature, how do you route messages to services. Maybe you have different tiers of services and different service level agreements depending on the quality of the kind of customer. You know, what endpoint to use, you know, service level agreements, all that kind of stuff. Versioning is another great example, different language requirements and so on. So all these are typically reside in that policy layer that should be abstracted out out of your business logic and refactored in this layer that should be, as I mentioned, declarative, configurable, and centrally managed. Right? So the other thing that you need to start thinking about, so that's from a technical perspective, it makes a lot of sense to do that decoupling of policy from business logic. The other thing that has become very, very important recently is the cost of governance, because we now live in a new regulatory environment that requires governance. You know, things like Sarbanes-Oxley, HIPAA, and so on. And a lot of these things cross different industries. It's not just for health or financial or what have you. SOC, for example, is across all industries. And non-compliance is expensive and is also personal responsibility. So all of a sudden, your CIO could go to jail or CEO could go to jail, and that gets their attention very, very quickly, believe me. So just having a policy enforcement is not enough. You actually need the ability to be able to, you need to be able to monitor what's going on in your organization. You need to be able to audit at different levels and different guises at different points, instrument your auditing at different points inside the organization under different conditions. You need to be able to take remedial action if necessary. So for example, if you detect a fraud, you need to be able to immediately shut down an account and generate a loss. So manual compliance monitoring is not sustainable anymore. You need automation for quality enforcement and compliance monitoring hand in hand. Right, so this is comfortable with an actionable policy framework. So all of a sudden, policy becomes very, very important. and policy enforcement and monitoring is crucial, both for an IT, for sort of agility and decoupling and loose coupling perspective, but also for governance, right? So how do you do that in practice? Well, it's relatively simple from a conceptual point of view. You use policy enforcement stuff. So if you think of your web services sitting on your app server somewhere and having a window and people being able to access them directly, all of a sudden you want to take that access away and put a layer in front of your services, a policy layer. So this is what I call the policy enforcement stuff, where you create policies around your services, and these policies are known to the policy enforcement point, through maybe a policy registry. And now that policy enforcement point intercepts any request coming inside your organization and checks it for policy. So for example, if you have a policy that says, well, if any of my suppliers are trying to access my inventory system, then they need to provide me with credentials, X509 maybe credentials, they need to be in my LDAP, let's say, and they need to encrypt their account ID, and they need to sign the request. But this is my policy for them to access my inventory system. Now, the policy enforcement point knows about this policy, and all its requests come in to access a particular system, it will check if all those things are there. If it's not there, then they'll have to do something, and that's part of the policy. But if it is there, then I'll pass the request over to the service, and then get the response back and send it back. So it acts as an intermediary between the service consumer and the service provider, and it checks ahead of enforcement policy. So now this is great for you if all you're doing is policy enforcement and you have a policy provider. You can look in there, again, the three, I'm going to keep repeating the mantra of policy, which is it needs to be declarative, it needs to be configurable, and needs to be centrally managed. Now if that's great, if that's the way you set it up, good for you, because then you can go and say, well, you know what, today I'm using HTTP basic authentication and service credentials, that's not strong enough for me anymore, my CIO, my organization has decreed that I need X509 tokens, you know, for credentialing, let's say, or SAML. You can go to your policy enforcement point, your policy mechanism, and you can make that change very, very easily. It's a configuration, it's a declarative configuration change. And now all of a sudden, all requests coming to your services need to have an X509 token header in WS security. What happened though is that it's very, very easy for you to do that, but what you've done in essence is you've broken everybody else's implementation, right? Because now they have to scramble and they have to rewrite their clients, their applications, in order to stop using HTTP basic auth, and instead they have to provision PTI, they have to start using X509 tokens, they have to implement WS security, all that kind of stuff. So in essence, you've pushed the burden onto the client applications anytime you use that kind of policy mechanism. So how do you solve that problem in order to decouple or loosely couple the client to not just the service provider? And the way you do that is you implement sort of a mirror image of the policy enforcement point at the client side, which is the policy application point. You could, I mean, this is an option, right? I'm sure I make that very, very clear. You don't have to do that because you can tell your client, if you're big enough, for example, and you don't care, you tell them tough. You can go, there's tons of tools out there that you can use to rewrite your client application in order to give me the X509 header token that I need. Right? It's your problem, you do it. Right? But if you don't want to do that, you want to be a little bit more flexible, then you can introduce this concept of an application point. Now, if you think of an enforcement point that takes all incoming requests and checks them against policy, you can think of an application point as a mirror image, sort of like a VPN client, but for web services. That lives on the client side, and it takes all outgoing requests, and it checks, and it knows about policy, and it will apply policy to the outgoing request. So if your policy says you need to give me an X509 token in the WS security header, you also need to sign, encrypt your account ID, and you need to send the request, the client all of a sudden, the client application is buffered from that. They're not aware of it. The application point, the policy application point will do all that. It will insert the header, it will sign and encrypt whatever is necessary, and then it will send the request down the line to the enforcement point. So all of a sudden now, you have really, truly, loosely coupled applications between clients and providers. All right. Sorry, I've duplicated this slide for some reason. So I'll move on to the next one. So to me, then all of a sudden you start seeing how the fundamental role of policy not just in building loosely coupled systems, but also in service-oriented architecture and instead of governance. right? So if you think of a policy life cycle that's ongoing, maybe an architect will offer your policy, you know, define other policies on privacy, integrity, non-mediation, identity access control, credentialing, reliability, all those things that architects are concerned with, you create that policy, then you deploy it. Your administration might deploy it to your policy enforcement point. The deployment includes physical endpoints, routing, load balancing, different task force. As an example, you might want to say that for external customers, I want to make this service available over HTTP. But for internal customers, I want to make it available over JMS. You know, so different transport mechanisms for the same service. Right, so these are the kind of policies that will happen at deployment point probably with my administrator and so on, and set up service level agreements, and then your policy enforcement point enforces these policies at the edge and inside the core. Things like access control, confidentiality, threat protection, confirmation and routing, and then very, very important for governance, things like alert, report, audit trail, and so on. And then there's an operations that monitors everything that's going on behind the office. Enforcement point monitors compliance with policies, they'll manage the alerts, they'll generate reports, they'll do forensic and audit trails, and if there are changes to be made to the policy, they'll go back and then, you know, have a report for change in the policy, right? So all of a sudden you have this ongoing cycle of modification, deployment, enforcement, and monitoring, and then remodification of the policy and things like that. And at every step of the way, you need to have some governance mechanism and some approval processes on anything, anybody that touches this policy. So the policy lifecycle also becomes a key aspect of thorough governance. And the main mechanism by which you affect that control is by the way you offer these policies, right? So offering your policies also becomes a fundamental aspect of policy. Now, the question becomes, well, that's great, I can offer these policies, but what do these policies look like? Because if you think about them, just like a record is a piece of metadata for your service, the policy is a complementary piece of metadata for the same service. What form should it take? So, if for example you use a very simple policy, you say I will accept either permalinks or username tokens if you want to access my service, but if you present me with a username token instead of permalinks token, I will log your request. Right? Very, very simple, maybe not very realistic, but it's simple. So the kind of metadata that you want to write is you want to say, well, I have this policy, and you choose, please choose one of these two alternatives. You either provide me with a server version 5 security token, or you present me with a username token, in which case I will audit. Right? So the very, very simple mechanism in which you want to convey these policies, right? So that's the kind of model that we're working towards. And to that effect, we've been working on this specification called WS Policy Framework, which we submitted to the W3C in April of last year, and it has come a very long way. It's a candidate proposed recommendation right now. You can actually go and check the website. It has excellent extensive vendor support. We actually have done several interops already between Layer 7 and IBM, VA, and Sun, and Microsoft, and a couple of other companies like HP and WebMethod, there's a lot of interruption, and up until that, we have been able to exchange policies using that standard mechanism, that standard specification. And, if I just quote out of the spec, framework defines the service policy framework defines framework and a model for expressing policies that refer to domain-specific capabilities, requirements, and then characteristics. Now, it says my entire team, but again, WebEx has somehow missed that. But, what they are now is all about domain specific. Because the one thing to remember, to keep in mind, that the policy framework is a general framework. It knows nothing about security, about messaging, about service level agreements, or anything like that. It just gives you a framework that you can use to build domain specific policies. And so the main WS policy specs are, there's two of them, there's the framework that's talked about, and then the policy attachment mechanism, which is a mechanism to attach fallacies to what sorts of description, either Wurzel or UDDI. The main two examples of places you can attack the policy is at the Wurzel level or at the UDDI level. So now, as I mentioned before, the policy spec is a framework that allows you to use to create domain specific. And two great examples of how that WS policy mechanism is used is on WS security policy and reliable messaging policy. So WS security policy is on the out. It's been notified as a spec by the way, and it's a domain-specific set of assertions that leverage WS policy framework and that are relevant to WS security, WS trust, and WS secure conversation. So you can actually create these kind of policies that tell your consumers of your services what kind of requirements you have, what kind of security requirements you have on your services. Reliable messaging policy obviously relates to reliability. Right? So this becomes more prevalent, more kind of domain-specific policy languages that use WS policy framework will start appearing. I just want to cover quickly the data model for WS policy, and then after that we can go through the demo. So, the root of the policy document, if you remember, is the policy outcome. And again, if you remember what we talked about, you want to be able to give choices and so on. So the same mechanism applies. You have, a policy contains several policy alternatives, and each policy alternative will contain several policy assertions. And the assertion of qualified name parameters, and they in turn can nest other policies, right? So this is sort of what you see on the left side, where you have a policy mechanism, and then a couple of different policy alternatives, and each alternative has policy assertions inside of it. Very simple data model. So if we use that data model, if we dispense with all the namespace and all that kind of stuff, all of those things, and we take that example that we had before here, and we render it using WS policy framework, we will have exactly almost an exact map where you say, this is the policy, this is my policy, and you can pick exactly one of these alternatives. Each alternative is bracketed by the all element. You can have, a code security token or a username token with an audit, right? So very, very simple mechanism. Here, and I'll give you some policies. You can take a look at them later. I think everybody will be provided with the PowerPoint. There's some published working drafts for the policy work group, and then a paper that we wrote around sort of the policy mechanism. At this point, I'm going to move to the authoring that help you work out a mechanism to for policy authoring. I just need to share, an application. Just 1 second. I apologize for that. All right. I'll talk about this in 1 second. All right. So I hope you're seeing that on your screen. If you're not, somebody please raise your arm. This is an example of an IDE for policy authoring. It happens to be our own product, Secure Spend Manager, that actually allows you to author policies and then deploy them to policy enforcement sites. For example, the Secure Spend Gateway. As you can see, there's tons of different things you can see here, but I'm just going to keep this relatively simple. And the use case here is I have a web service, I have a web service endpoint, and I want to secure it, or I want to put the policy mechanism in front of it, so I can control who accesses it and under what conditions and what they're doing. So I want to create a whole policy layer in front of the actual physical endpoint. So in order to do that, I say, all right, I want to publish a web service. And here you can do lots of things. You can browse the UDDI registry to grab the WSDL. And in my instance, I have the URL for the WSDL of that particular server. And I actually want to just resolve it. So get resolved. And at this point, there are lots of other things you can do. This is a wizard that allows you to create access control, if you see here, at the front end. If you think of a policy enforcement point as being an intermediary between a client, a web service client or requester, and a web service provider, you can have policy mechanism at the front end for the incoming firm, and policy mechanism at the back end for the request going from the first report to the actual available endpoint. Actually, I'm going to dispense with the wizard because I want to show a little bit more the actual policy author mechanism. So I'm just going to say finish here. And now we have an actual policy container right here. Now, policy container is probably the simplest thing you can have. It just has one assertion, which is a routing assertion. And that's just saying all requests that come asking for this particular service, you route them to this particular physical endpoint. The nice thing about this, even though it is very simple, already it has huge benefits. So, for example, you can go and modify the physical endpoint. What happens if you've moved your service from one platform to the other, or from one app server to the other, or even from one port to the other, from one location to the other? You can go and say, you know, I've moved this service from this port to this other port, it's listening to another port. And you go, change it. You haven't broken any client. The client still knows the old wisdom that gets them to the actual policy enforcement point. And then your policy layer is the one that takes those requests coming in and then decides where to send them. In this case, it's going to start sending them to the new endpoint without breaking anything. So already it's providing you with a very, very important loose coupling mechanism between your clients and your services. Even though it's very, very simple. But let's move on to other more important things and more interesting things. So you see here on the left, there's a palette of a lot of assertions that are grouped in different folders. There's a new logical grouping, you know, not necessarily structure, but, you know, you have access control handle assertions, you have transport layer assertions, external security assertions, you know, also, I'll go through some of them. But the first thing you might want to do is to create some kind of access control mechanism around your service endpoints, right? So you say, well, you know, I'm going to grant some access to server groups. Right. So here, so the third part of your policy auditing and your policy offering is you need to have an integration with all your access control mechanisms, whether you have LDAP or Access Directory, or a variety of different identity access management systems, such as Cellular Access Manager, or, you know, SiteMinder, or Tivoli. You need to be able to integrate those inside with your policy application part, so your policy enforcement part. So that's a very, very important aspect of any kind of policy offering. Right? So in this case, I have access to a lot of different identity providers. I'm just going to use precipitation and LDAP that exists inside my organization, and I'm going to say, all right, now I'm going to give access to all sales, maybe. To anybody who belongs to the sales group, I'm going to give them access to the service, right? Now, why do you see, so another sort of policy offering is validation. Because as you create policies, you might be creating policies that are useless or invalid. So, policy offering, as I mentioned, is a very, very powerful tool. And so, you know, to call Spidey, you know, with a great power comes great responsibility, right? So you need to be able to validate the policies that you're creating, and so an automatic validator is a crucial element of your policy offering. So here, my validator is all constantly validating anything that I create, and it's found that there's a couple problems with the policy that I just created. In essence, there's access control, it says error, access control specified without an authentication scheme. In essence, you're telling me who's allowed to access the service, but not how they're going to authenticate. So, okay, so you're right. So let's use something very simple such as basic auth, right? So now all of a sudden this policy is validated, okay? And now I have a very, very simple policy that says only identities belonging to the sales group are allowed to access the policy, and the way they authenticate is they need to provide me with a basic auth. Very, very simple policy. And all of a sudden, your service is protected. Now, that's sort of the beginning. That's as simple as you can get. Now, policy becomes very, very interesting and very important for governance and auditing and so on as you start creating more richer and more complex policies. So let me give you an example. What if you want to have different rules for different for different types of users or different types of identities? What if you had maybe internal it's really good. Thanks again for that inventory example that I gave earlier. But if you want internal processing, business process, access to the inventory system, but under certain conditions, but you want to also have external suppliers and partners to access your inventory system, again, under different things. So this is where policy becomes very, very interesting, and this is where we use the concept of policy. You can start doing actual policy logic. You can say, if you remember the WS policy mechanism that I showed you where you can have policy alternatives that you can pick from. Okay, so I want to say, for all internal sales processes, I want to, they have to provide me with a basic authentication, but if they're external partners, let's say, if they're remote users, let's say, I actually will require WS Security X509 token, right? And I will route them both to the same, okay, or can I route, let's say I'm going to route them to different servers, to different endpoints, even better, right? So I go to my routing, message routing, and if they're external, I'm routing them to my HTTP server, and if they're internal, I'm going to route them to my DNS queue. Right, just for fun, just for this. So now all of a sudden, I have very, very differentiated kinds of policy that exists at the policy layer, at the policy offering layer, without having touched any code or my deployed actual web service. Right? This is a very, very important mechanism. I want to, again, keep hitting on the same concept of having policy being declarative, configurable, and sensible, which is very, very crucial. Right? So now all of a sudden, I have differentiated types of access control. Now, I can do some interesting things. I can then say, well, you know what? And if it's one of my internal sales organizations, I actually want to log, I want to send an SNMP track because it's highly unusual for somebody on the inside to be able to access that service. So I want to send an SNMP track and, you know, anyway, I'm going to cancel this one. I have to redefine my SMP card. But in essence, you can drag and drop an SMP, and also it'll publish SMP track. But maybe let's say I want to send an email to somebody, right? So now, if somebody from internal sales have authenticated correctly and they've accessed, I'm going to route them to the DNS queue, but also I'm going to send an email alert to somebody inside the organization, to my admin inside the organization. Now, if somebody from external, one of my external partners have to use it, I actually want to require certain things. I want them to maybe sign the request, and maybe I want them to encrypt a particular element inside the request. So I want them to say, maybe if they're placing an order, I want them to encrypt their account ID, right? So all of a sudden, I'm creating some very, very complex and rich policies around accessing the service that give me all the sales, that give me integrity, confidentiality, notification, all those great things without touching my deployed code again, you know, and making it very, very, like I said, declarative, configurable, and centrally managed. And then maybe I want to say, and I also want to create a detailed assertion here, an audit detail. So I want to say, external users, right? And then also that gets logged at the info level in my audit log, right? So now also I have an audit trail, I have all kinds of security mechanisms, access control, confidentiality, integrity, notification, and even routing, you know? So there's other things that I can do. So for example, I can say with my policy offering mechanism, I can say, and you know what, internal sales are all external users that the interviews can only allow to use the service between 8 and 5. Right? So all of a sudden I can label that inside my policy, and then I can restrict things like throughput, like the address range, and so on, lots of different service level agreements that have policy. Now if I think in terms of maybe threat protection, I want to say, and you know what, for anybody coming in, I need you to validate the schema, right? Message argument and monitor this URL, right? So all of a sudden, so I'm saying that all the requests are coming in, I need to do schema validation on, and then I'll decide that it's internal, I will restrict to a certain time of day, then need to authenticate some way, allow them somewhere, and if it's external, I need to do some other things. Right? So as you see, all of a sudden, I can create very, very rich policies in my policy offering environment that are important for news companies, that are also very, very important for governance, for other traces, tracking for non-mitigation and things like that. So, you know, there's lots of other things that we can do here that actually are even a lot more powerful than I'm showing you here, but I just wanted to give you an aspect of policy authoring and the concept of policy authoring, how it relates to policy governance, and then the role of policy in news coupling and in governance. And at this point, I just wanted to stop here at the 45-minute mark because I do want to leave time for questions. But if you want to see more of, you know, things like routing or validation, transformation, maybe I'll give one more example, actually, that's very important. So I mentioned earlier, one of the things that you want to do with policy authoring and policy force report is be able to do things like versioning, right? So I want to be able, maybe internally we use different versions, I want to be able to evaluate an XPath inside the document, and I look inside the payload and make decisions based on context. So I can say, well, you know what, this is the XPath, and if the order, you know, and so this particular product I need, then I want to do something, and so on, right? So, so all of a sudden, the policy authoring document can allow you to create XPath and to look inside your document to make decisions and branching and routing and access control based on content, but also you can actually do things like transformation for versioning, for example. You want to say, well, if it's internal, I want, if I'm sending it on my DNS queue, before I actually send it to DNS queue, my DNS queue has a little bit of format. We know the older version, so I actually want to be able to transfer the message using my using a particular style sheet to confirm my DNS or the person I HTTP service. So you can do lots of things like that in the policy offering environment that then get deployed to policy enforcement stuff. Alright? So I'm going to stop here because if I go through all the different assertions that we have here, it'll take me several hours. I just want to give you a flavor of policy offering and the policy offering environment, and then how important it is for governance and loose coupling and so on. At this point, I will take some questions. I don't know what the mechanism is for questions, but can you see? Let me see if I can actually take questions.
Not awesome.
Okay, I have questions. That were typed into the chat here. So will these slides be available at the end of the session? Yes, of course. I'm pretty sure that they will be available. If not, I will make sure that they are. I'll ask Ada, who's organizing this talk, this webinar, to make sure to get everybody's email. But hang on, just one second. Thank you for sharing here. So that if you have any questions, or if you have requests for these presentations and so on, please send me an email about it, and I will make sure that you get it. Right? Okay. I have a great question that says, where does XACMO fit into this finer grained authorization policy offering model? That's a wonderful question. Thank you, Pavan, for asking it. Now, XACMO, just so that everybody is on the same baseline, is the XML access control model language. It's actually two different things in the same specification. I think about it that way. It's a way to convey access control information. to render access control policies, and it's also a sort of redundant response protocol that allows you to query a policy decision point about access control decisions. So you can say, you can send an XAML request to maybe an identity or access management system and ask it, is this particular identity allowed to access this resource or this, you know, at this time, and then you get a response back. So XAML is a great mechanism for that, but it also does have a policy mechanism. And the question is, well, how does it fit into the standard grid authorization policy model? And to me, this is actually something that we're working on right now in the community, but XAML is the mechanism, as far as I'm concerned, that will allow you to create access control. Now, if you saw earlier that the policy framework is sort of subject domain agnostic. If it's subject domain agnostic, so you have things like WS security policy, WS around our veteran policy, I believe the way we're leading towards is to take XAML and be able to wrap it inside a WS policy document and render specific access control policies through XAML inside a WS policy document. And actually, that's what I believe we're what the community is saying. But XAML is a perfect mechanism to do. Just like we have a mechanism to render security policy and a mechanism to render reliable messaging policy, XAML will be able to render access control policy inside the global WS policy framework.
Another question, Deepak is asking, how do you manage policies for liability and high availability? For example, capability of starting up additional copies of the digital components on servers with unutilized capacity.
Okay, so that's reliability and so that's actually an interesting question because there's a philosophical debate as to whether the policy enforcement point do versus whether your global policy do. I believe that you should be able to specify that part of your service level agreement, right? What kind of response time, and you need to be able to monitor that kind of response time and be able to affect decisions on maybe starting up new servers or what have you, if the response time starts to fall. So in that policy mechanism that I showed you before, you should be able to specify a service level agreement threshold. Now, how you affect that threshold is a different question. You should be able to say, you know, if that threshold is reached, I want you to do something about it, right? And send an alert to somewhere else. Now, there are already tons of mechanisms already in place by large vendors that have been in place for years and years and years to allow you to do load balancing and on-demand and things like that. And I don't believe that the actual mechanism should exist in your policy mechanism, in your policy offering. I think your policy offering, policy enforcement should only decide what your policy is. And once a threshold has been reached, then you send an alert or some kind of request to your load balancer or your on-demand server services or to whatever infrastructure you have that allows you to manage these response times. Right? So that's sort of the interaction between policy enforcement, policy offering, policy enforcement, and then the rest of the IT infrastructure. Now that's a great, great question, actually, and it fits right into your policy model. There's no doubt about that. All right. I have another question here that says, have you thought about policy negotiation? Oh, great. Actually, thank you for that question. So the question is, how do we talk about policy negotiation? And this takes us away a little bit from the concept of policy offering, but I don't mind answering that question because it's a very interesting question. So to me, there's two different mechanisms. There are different entities that interact within your service or architecture. There are entities that are service providers, there are entities that are service consumer services, and there are entities that are both. Now, the question is not the service provider alone should have a policy, but the consumer of the service should have a policy too. And that policy is not necessarily only based on what it wants to do, it might be based on its capabilities, maybe a request of a service does not have the capability to generate the X509 token. So we need to be able to negotiate a policy with the service provider in order to that they agree on some kind of mechanism. Now, if you think that's far-fetched, I kind of disagree, because that kind of mechanism happens millions of times every day, and it's called the SSL handshake. In essence, what happens at the SSL is the new browser, let's say, and the app server, the web, that the web server negotiate the capabilities and requirements between each other so that they can create an SSL session. I think the same kind of negotiation mechanism should exist at the WSL level, at the source and web services level, so that a service consumer, service provider, can actually interact. And again, that gets down to the policy layer, so that the actual consumer and the actual service provider are isolated from all that kind of stuff, right? I have lots of questions going on. I don't have time to answer all of them, but I will try to get through as many of them as I can. Farvat is asking again, does this solution allow applications to locally catch policy decisions made by a centralized server? In other words, how is CAC can handle the low performance bottlenecks? Yes, obviously, it's an administrator option. You can actually, as an administrator, you can go in and say catch policy decisions, or you can say don't catch them, go at it every time. Again, it depends on the preferences of the administrator. If performance is a big issue, then of course you catch. If actually you don't want performance to be an issue for you, but you actually are very intent on having the decision made every time, then you can disable caching, and then it'll not fail the cache, it'll go back to the false decision point every time. John has asked a question. This will probably be the last question I take, unfortunately, because we're running out of time. But John asked, can what policy call the web service to retrieve values for determining access control and use values from the web service in the policy rules? Yes, of course. Actually, that's a great question. Thanks, John. That's something actually that I haven't talked about, because I didn't want to get into complexities. I didn't want to give you guys a flavor of the policy offering environment. But yes, of course, this is a topic that we call context variables. So context variables are variables that you create, or variables that are created automatically. Here, if I go back to Sherry, I just want to show you something very, very quickly. Just one second. Let me reactivate Sherry. Okay, so if you look here, if I hover over the routing, you see there's a couple of things in there. Set, HTTP routing, latency, and service URL. These are two variables that are set automatically anytime you create a routing assertion, right? In addition to these automatic sort of system kind of variables, you can set any kind of variables you want using the variable mechanism. You can say set variable, you can drag it, and then you can set it to any number you want, or you can set it to any kind of expression. You can set it to the result of an expression inside the table, or you can set it to some kind of external value that you get through a callout. Now that variable becomes part of your context, and then you can use it anywhere you want. You can use it in the logging file, you can use it to make decisions, you can correlate with other variables, you can do variable comparisons, you can compare to other variables and make decisions based on that. So your policy authoring in your environment is very, very powerful in that method, that way, and it allows you to create all these variables in a lot of different ways, and then use them in terms of access control. Other kinds of, not just access control, but routing decisions, service level agreements, and things like that inside the policy environment. Alright, so at this point, we're out of time, and I see there are other questions. I apologize, but if you have questions, please don't hesitate to email them to me, and I will make sure your questions get answered one way or another. And if also you have, you need copies of the presentation, again, please contact me, and I'll make sure that you get them. At this point, I'm going to end the webinar. Thank you very much all for attending, and again, if you have any questions, just email me. Thanks. Bye.